Okay, thank you very much, and a special thank you to Lou, who made this link possible while the repeater is still having some degree of sensitivity problems. I am AC2GS, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. My first name is Roy. Most people know me by now, Romeo Oscar Yankee. And this is the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong since 1982 under the wisdom of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key last year. But the TechNet goes on. And so, as always, I will remind you of a few things before we begin this session, as we do all. If you have any questions, you can't get onto the technical net for whatever reason, or topics or puzzles you'd like to share, we have a few puzzles available for later tonight, which I hope I will be able to get to. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a space-related story and give an opinion, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I have a whole number of interesting links available every week. I refresh them with a new list, and I leave the old list behind if you're interested. There's stories that I might be able to get to on the Science Talk segment, if that's possible. And if not, you could read the articles yourself. There are a couple of other articles that don't really lend themselves for the radio because they're visual. So I put that up front. And please, avail yourself of my link page. All you have to do is type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page. There's a chat room available. You can either go to Limark's web pages and find the link there, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. I stream an audio stream of the repeater, so that if you do not have access to a Echo Link or a radio or IRLP, just with a browser and an internet connection, you can get the audio stream. You just type into that your browser under those circumstances, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you an audio stream. And we keep it alive 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, usually. We also like to remind people, Mike, KC2NJI, has a wonderful art
into the WGR
2007. Information is still pertinent, and Dick and Eric and John and all the great guys who unfortunately became silent keys through the years have left a great deal of wisdom behind. Please listen to it and learn from it. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, I timed that reasonably well. Tonight's schedule is pretty much similar to the previous one. I will ask if anyone has any topics or questions and ask them to hit the push to talk and give me their first name and their call sign, and we'll make a list up, and we'll take the questions or the topics by the order of the list. Somewhere between 8:30 and 8:45, I will pause the list to introduce Andy, WA2CDL, in Andy's Corner, which I'm looking forward to tonight. He will present another episode of Andy's Corner, and when he's done, I will pick it up again and finish up the questions and maybe offer a couple of interesting puzzles for the audience. And if we have time, we can do some science articles as well. And then around 10:15 or so, we will ask Paul, WS2N, to bring on his SpaceNet report. That should take us to about 11 p.m. I will come back once again to tie a bow on it and wish everyone well. So that's the plan for tonight, and I hope we succeed. We don't do it without the participation of you people out there. You guys make or break these technical nets. If you have any questions of a technical nature and you would like to share them, or topics or comments of some question that was asked before and you found the results later on, please give me your first name and your call sign.
TD2VDW, Mike.
Okay, Mike recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
2VAW.
Please say again, you cut yourself off at the beginning. Someone signed in and all I could hear was the AW, so if you could please repeat it, I'd appreciate it.
Curtis, KC2DAW.
Okay, KC2AW, recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, Mike, you're up first. What's your question for tonight?
Well, now that the weather is getting warmer and trips up to the roof are possible, I was looking at my situation, and my neighbor behind me has a pole that's, you know, used for a clothesline. So I asked him today if I could use it. Long story short, it looks like my antenna is going to be sort of an inverted L, sorry, inverted V, because my chimney's lower than the peak, so it would go from the chimney maybe 10 feet and then slope down to that clothesline 30 feet. My question is how far away from the roof should I put the standoff? I was going to put like a PVC pipe at the top to hold the wire off the roof and get a little more height.
A metal lined roof, right?
No, but the only problem is that it would travel over a 2 foot round aluminum cover for an attic fan.
Okay, well, obviously you don't want it touching it. You know, I mean, approximately, if you put it up about 6 feet away from that container, I can't see it having any kind of problems whatsoever. All things being equal, the higher that you put these things, especially at the feed point, that's where a significant amount of the RF current is emitted, the better. But all things being equal, as long as you don't have the wire sliding on bits and pieces of metal, I don't see a problem. See, the only major problem you have with roofs would be on the rare occasion where they're, you know, copper lined or something. So they're effectively their own grounding plane. Now, some people can use that to their benefit. So people who have situations like that, things like a vertical, very nice to play with because you have that enormous ground plane. But you wouldn't want something like that if you were trying to maneuver some horizontal dipole in any kind of configuration. So I would say it's just a matter of a few feet just to make sure that it doesn't wipe around it or get very close to it. The high voltage at the edges of dipoles is a thing, but again, the way you describe it wouldn't concern me too much. I would just make sure it was a few feet away from that.
Okay, yeah, my question in my head is, since I'm going to be mounting like a 2-inch diameter PVC pipe, you know, sort of on the peak, pulled down by the weight of the wire and the tension, I'm going to try and guy it left to right also. So, you know, it's just a matter of, will it stay up there in the wind?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the perennial problem with anything like this. With pretty much anything that you put up, will it stay there? It depends upon how structurally rigid the system is and if it has give. If you do research, if you Google it, if you look through back issues of QSC and such, you will see an endless stream of clever people who set up weights and pulleys and springs so that if the structures get pulled too much, they won't snap apart. Always good to get the best quality guy rope that you can afford. Don't cheap out and get something from Harbor Freight that's not UV protected and such. And then it's sort of a way that it sounds like you're doing it is there's not a lot of shift in position. The wind will force things just because of the air resistance, but you're not putting it on a tree that sways in the wind. So if the laundry pole is as steady as most laundry poles that I've had to deal with, you don't get a lot of movement out of them. So just, you know, don't cheap out on the guy rope, and make things as tight as you can. And even though, you know, you do all the right things, there's no guarantee that the wind won't gust high enough, and you know, metal fatigue has an additive effect, and it might go snap in the night someday. But you know, that's part of the hobby, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, actually, coming off of that laundry pole to a plastic pulley and then using a fishing weight to hold the... So that's something I could consider. And the rope I'll be using is old 7 mil climbing rope. I mean, so it should be no problem on that.
Okay, just make sure that it has UV protection, because one of the things that doesn't correlate with a lot of ropes that people just use for some activity and then pack them away, is this is going to be out in the UV day in and day out, and it can age things prematurely. Also, I personally would suggest if you're interested in something higher quality, if you get a marine designed pulley, they're usually a little bit more expensive, but they're a lot more sturdy than just a generic pulley that you would buy in the hardware store. So you might want to consider looking into those. It's a bit of a premium, but it tends to last a little bit longer from what I hear and from my own experiences.
The majority plastic?
No, not at all. This is you're running a guy rope through it, which is non-conducting, so it's immaterial. You don't have to. It doesn't have to be insulating in the slightest. So, I mean, my marine pulleys were metal with lubrication and bearings in them.
If I'm going, so like again, I was in an inverted V. If I go all the way there to the end, does it pay at all to give it that 10, 15 feet of vertical on the wire? So in other words, extend the wire through, say, a plastic pulley or some point, and then bring it straight down?
Okay, I mean, yeah, I was thinking more of just a straight dipole with egg insulators or something and ropes. If you were planning to extend the wire, then you certainly would want to use something plastic. You may not want to or need to use a pulley system for that part of it. You may just get some kind of insulating loop that could be mounted on it and just kind of, you know, a low friction type of thing. And then have another weight bearing system below it. So that's another option. But it sort of depends upon what frequencies you want to use. All things being equal, it's probably best to go for a mechanically resonant antenna, because if you have something, you're going to end up having a higher Q and a shorter bandwidth. Although if you have a antenna tuner in the shack and the losses from the transmission line aren't too bad, it's something that people can live with. So it sort of depends on the frequencies. If you want to, you can try it out as a full-length L type of configuration with an extra length and see if that extra length gives you any particular benefit.
What I plan to do is put the wire up there with somebody and then, you know, see how much wire it is, what's the footage, and then go at that with recommendations on resonant length for the inverted beam to go from there. Like if it's too long or I can't get it resonant, I'll use a 9-to-1 on. If not, then I'll do something else. Thank you again, Roy.
Okay, you're welcome, Mike, and as always, for things like that, it's always good to have a good antenna tuner. It can correct a whole bunch of things. You might be able to correct a certain band at the point of the balance, when you get off that particular portion of the frequency, the impedance might shift beyond, 2 to 1, and then an antenna tuner becomes a very useful device. You'll get some arguments on the HF bands. People, a couple of them out there, they love resonant antennas, and they think that using an antenna tuner is just a confidence kind of trick that people are talked into, but they are effective. They do introduce some kind of loss depending upon what kind of transmission line you use, but it's a very useful thing to have in a compromised residence. So keep that in mind.
Thank you again. Yeah, I was feeling really confident about my plan until I looked at my neighbor's yard over this past weekend, and his antenna that's been up there for as long as I can remember came down with this wind. So I got some planning to do. Thank you again, Roy.
You're welcome, Mike. Good luck, and come back and tell us how it all came out.
Thank you,
Mike. Okay, next on the list, and I think I don't have the entire call sign. The way I wrote it was KC2AW. If that's not what it is, if you could correct me, I'd appreciate it, and then you can ask your question.
AW, with no question, just supporting the net.
Okay, understood. You're just supporting the net. Was that what you were going to tell me, Paul?
No. I was going to comment on the last topic.
Okay, well, we don't have any other topic. We just have that topic now, so please, feel free.
Okay, I tried before, but I wound up doubling. I'm coming through Selden, so that's what happened there. Had the dipoles up there many years, different dipoles. And for quite a few years, I had a clothesline plastic pulley to take the clack out of the antenna going up and down. Plus, it was tied onto two trees, so sometimes they would move pretty good. And it worked. It was interesting to watch the weight go up and down. I used a cinder block. One of these very dense cinder blocks. It probably weighed about 50 pounds. It was one of the heavier ones. So, you watch it go up and down, and that's pretty good. But then one day I went out there, and I saw it swinging back and forth. What happens is, as the wind is going by, sometimes it creates, it pushes on the block, and the next thing you know, it creates a red. Thing was swinging back and forth. I couldn't believe it. So that's not safe. If you had a kid back there, you could knock him over. So what I did is I just took a longer length and tied it to the bottom of the cinder block and just create a lot of slack in that length going to the ground. And then, you just put a big spike into the ground. And this way, it could only swing back and forth so far. So it's just, just something, that you might be interested in. Roy, back to you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it sort of reminds me of a very unfortunate case with a bridge. The engineers have not really figured out what the harmonics, what the resonance was for the bridge. And they had a troop of people marching, trotting down the bridge in just the right frequency for the resonance. And it became structurally disastrous. They had to redesign parts of it to kind of dampen those resonance frequencies. So yeah, that's one of the downsides of the pulley weight system. I've seen other articles where they put springs in line with this situation. This is all kinds of very interesting ideas people have. You know, in the end, the second law of thermodynamics always wins out. Entropy always increases. Antennas always inevitably come down. There's nothing you can do except forestall the inevitable. So, you know, use good equipment. Don't use used stuff. Don't use stuff that's not designed for the outside. And someone will invent a better mousetrap given enough time. So thanks to Paul. I appreciate that take on how to dampen the problems with aerials and keeping them up there.
Okay, very good. And I'm one of you talking about the Tacoma Bridge in Washington. That's the one that eventually came down with the high winds, and it set up a resonance. It got the nickname Galloping Gertie. Well, was that another one with the troops with the, you know, walking on the bridge? Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, that was another one because they actually were able to fix it. They basically just blocked everyone from using it, and then they reinforced parts of it so that it dampened the harmonics. But yeah, that particular bridge, as you mentioned, was kind of the prototype of what you shouldn't do, and engineers every so often forget about it and come up with rather dangerous designs out there. I forget, there was some kind of the Learning Channel special upon engineering faux pas. Usually engineers tend to over-engineer things, thankfully. Every so often they'll miss one level of review, or someone will come by at the very end of design phase and introduce a modification and rush it along so that no one has a chance to model it and such. I remember there was a hotel that had connections to a bridge to another building that had a problem. That they wanted to make it look nicer, and so they didn't engineer it as over-engineered as usual, and the thing gave way and killed people. So unfortunately that happens. A lot of things are built, and humanity is not 100% perfect, so these things happen. But yeah, I remember the Tacoma Bridge as well. That was a terrible accident.
Yeah, but as I remember, nobody got killed on that one. I think a couple of cars, people got out of their cars and ran, and the cars went down, but no people. Very good, Roy. I'll let you continue. WS2N.
Okay, very good, Paul. So once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limewalk Technical Net. If anyone has any other technical questions tonight, and they just popped into their heads, or they thought that things were going to be too busy for them. But we have a little time here, so if anyone else has any questions or topics of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Yeah, Wayne, KD2UDU, with sort of an update question, I think.
Okay, Wayne, what is it?
If you recall, but I bought a boat anchor through Limewalk, and so I was making repairs, and I was supposed to get together with Andy, but our schedules didn't coincide. So I wound up buying a Variac, and after I did all the repairs and did all the soldering, I powered the unit up, and to my happiness, it did not smoke, and it powered up for a while, but then it started blowing the fuse. First it blew the fuse in the Variac, and then I switched it to, you know, just a regular commercial power. The Variac fuse was a 5-amp fuse, and then it started blowing the 10-amp fuse in the power supply. It's a two component radio. It's a separate power supply connected by a 12 conductor power cord to the radio. So where it stands right now is I'm at a standstill. Basically, I'm not sure what other repairs I have to make. I did not get receive. I was attempting to tune it up, but I didn't get a receive. I had no stations coming in at all. I was trying to tune it up on 10 meters earlier today. I have a 10-meter dipole antenna that I had it connected to. So, your thoughts on the power supply blowing fuse?
Fantastic.
We do have Andy waiting for Andy's corner, and if he'll avail us, I'd like to have his opinion, because he's a guy who fixes these things all the time. Like, there's a short. If there's a short in the power supply, my question would be that when you repaired or replaced some of the components, it was my understanding from talking to Andy that the RF choke, the inductor, wasn't really that important in the design of the radio, so it could have simply been bypassed.
Attention.
No, electrolytes are usually the first component to kind of go bad over a given amount of time. So did you change the electrolytes in the power supply, or is it possible that some of the smoothing capacitors could have a built-in short or a partial short? You know, sometimes it's not an all or nothing. Sometimes it's someplace in between. So what components did you replace when you were working on it?
I'm here, WHCDL, and Wesley's also checking in.
Maybe you want to take it away with Wayne, because you're much more familiar with these devices.
Electrolytic capacitor that was right next to the inductor that got burnt. All the other capacitors looked okay. I didn't test them, but they weren't physically leaking. Whether they're leaking electrically, I can't say. I guess I'm due for a visit to Andy.
Hi, this is Wayne, WHCDL.
Hey, I don't know if you heard my tale of woe.
I did. If you give me a call on the phone. But not right now, because I'm going to be doing, my little corner thing. I can speak to you sometime during the week. I'm working this week, though. But I can talk to you about it and ask you a few questions.
Hey, what's a good time to call you?
Tomorrow in the afternoon, but later on, like around 3, 4 o'clock. Is that good?
Not really. I'll try. I usually start work at 3. Like I said earlier, our schedules don't seem to coincide very well.
Hi, I'm working this week. We'll figure out something.
See, I know you're the man to go to. Unfortunately, we didn't get together. I don't know if you heard me tell Roy, I wound up buying a Variac and powering it up, and it doesn't smoke, but it's blowing the fuse.
Okay, not a problem. That could be corrected. Doesn't sound like it's a major thing. Okay, just mention that.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Wayne. I just want to add for the general audience that although obviously you open up a machine and capacitors look like they've exploded or they're kind of slowly leaking, That's a dead giveaway that there's something terribly wrong. But electrolytic capacitors can be a little sneaky too. They can look pretty much normal, and unless you have equipment to test the ESR and you know whether it's an open or a short, they can hide in plain sight. So although you know it's easy to tell a bad capacitor. When it's really bad, sometimes you might miss a bad capacitor that just is sitting there quietly looking perfectly fine. So something for everyone to keep in mind. Even both ohm meters these days have abilities to test for capacitance. Not quite the same for ESR, equivalent resistance, but series resistance. But good luck, Wayne, and come back when your radio is working. And if you're able to get 10 meters running, I have a 10-meter net that I run every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28380 upper sideband. Please come by and say hello.
I'd love to. I do have a working 10-meter rig in my mobile. So I will definitely try and tune in next Sunday morning.
Okay, very good, Wayne. Thank you very much. Well, it's 8:32, and I guess it's as good a time as any to bring on Andy, WA2CDL, with Andy's Corner.
All right, very good, WA2CDL. But before we do that, I just want to take a pause because Wesley, N2XJN, was calling. So you may have some information. So, Roy, I'm giving it back to you. Fine, just see if he wants to talk to you about something.
Okay, Wesley, you out there? You want to ask a question, raise a topic, make a comment?
No. Andy is more important. Thank you.
All right, I'm happy. I'm more important. All right, thank you, Wesley, because I heard you before. And if Mike is still listening, I was in the background. I was listening to Mike talk about his antenna installation of his dipole. There's a couple of ideas that I used in my installation, and I could pass it on to you, Mike, if you're still listening. With the way I did it, from previous experience and having antennas come down. So anyway, just thought I'd mention that. All right, anyway, back. This is Andy's Corner, and my name is Andy. The late CDL is my call, and this is a continuing discussion and talk about the topic that I've been. Focusing on, which is antennas and propagation, and we were actually talking about the dipole antenna in the past week, and the antenna impedance of the dipole's impedance, and the current and voltage nodes and loops, as they call it, and the equivalent schematic of what a dipole antenna looks like, which is basically a series resonant circuit, and so on. We also spoke about antenna dimensions and how to figure out the length in feet for a half-wave dipole, which I think, Mike, if you're listening, you were asking, there's a formula for that. And if you you could look all this stuff up, by the way, right on the internet. You can go. The internet is so has so much information, as you know, Wikipedia and everything else, and we all use this because I don't remember half the things that I even say, you know, as I get older. So just thought I'd mention that. If you want to look up the length and feet of a half-wave dipole, there are charts and graphs, and just do a Google search for that. It'll give you all the information. So it's right there. Okay, so continuing our discussion, and another change is tomorrow, I am working this week, and unfortunately, the Long Island Rail, I take the train, and the Long Island Rail has changed their schedule starting tomorrow. So I just looked up the schedule, and it turns out that I gotta figure out the best way to get in without changing trains, because now the schedule's different, and I have a class that starts in the morning, and I gotta be there and not be late. So I gotta figure this out, which is what I was doing before. I only mention that is I'm not gonna make it a long night tonight on the net, because I have to I gotta figure out the schedule, which I was doing partially today anyway. But for some reason, the Long Island Railroad updates did not give me the schedule for tomorrow. They kept saying check back later. So don't know why. Which I'm trying to figure out the schedule for tomorrow. Anyway, so let me continue with the discussion, and then I will take it from there. All right, the last topic in regard to dipoles was, I was talking about a folded dipole, and the advantage and disadvantage of using folded dipoles. It's got a much higher impedance, in the order of 300 ohms or so, according to what this is mentioned. And it consists, because it's a folded dipole, of two different resonant circuits, parallel and series. So, there wasn't really a big discussion about it, but just to mention that you could put up a folded dipole, and one advantage of it is it's more broad-banded. It's more of a broad-banded antenna. And they went into a little discussion of how it becomes broad-banded because of the reactive, the reactants above and below resonance, either inductive or capacitive, makes it broader in a sense. So there's an advantage to that. All right, and that's what I was talking about last week. So continuing now, it's the next topic, which I didn't get into, is called antenna loading. And this is what it says. It's a relatively short discussion here. So, in regard to antenna loading, and I hope guys are following along from week to week, because it's a continuing discussion. I can't go back that far from each week, because it'll take up too much time just to, rediscuss what we already spoke about. So, I guess it's like going to class, each class is continuing from the previous class. So antenna loading. The characteristic of a dipole antenna can also be altered by adding mass or changing the shape of the ends of the dipole elements, as shown in this figure that they're describing it. This procedure is referred to as end loading. The use of end loading permits the overall length of the antenna structure to be shortened and still be resonant at the desired frequency. There happens to be, as a footnote, there was a QST article on shortened dipole antennas that are resonant, and even though they're short, and how to add loading coils or loading traps, a coil and a capacitor in parallel, at certain locations along the dipole, which effectively or electrically makes it longer than it really is. So by adding that, it looks, electrically it looks longer, but it's actually shorter. So that's what antenna loading is called. And there's some interesting articles. There was one in QST on how to build such a thing. So if you have limited space and you want to put up an antenna, let's say for 75 or 160 meters, which is quite long, you could actually make it shorter with these loading devices, which is a coil and a capacitor, a loading network. In this particular case, they're using flat circular discs or other metallic configurations attached to the ends of the dipole. And it's shown here in this figure, which caused the capacity of the antenna to rise. A shorter antenna can then be used to obtain resonance at the same frequency. Now, it doesn't go into all the math and everything involved with this. It's just a general discussion. A further shortening of the antenna element can be made by inserting inductance between the metallic discs and the antenna element itself. That's what I just mentioned. I was just mentioning inductance in series. So it says that. And they show a figure of what that looks like also. You have an inductor placed, they're showing it at the very end of the dipole. The discussion that I saw in QST uses formulas to figure out where to install it in the dipole, you know, along the dipole length, without decreasing the dipole's efficiency, because it is critical where those inductors are placed, although I don't think this discussion will go into that. That I see. So, it says, by the way, I got to get that QST article, the year and month, and I can mention that next time, because I don't have it here in front of me, the QST I'm talking about. It was an article that I was interested in talking about, but it gets into a little bit of math. And that could be a little bit tricky to try to figure out, because it does go into that discussion. Yeah, just keep in mind, these discussions here are just basically to convey the information of what can be done without getting into the depths of it. So, as I just mentioned, a further shortening of the antenna element can be made by inserting inductances between the metallic discs and the antenna element itself, and they show it in the figure. In such an arrangement, both the antenna capacitance and inductance are increased by end loading. The antenna can be loaded at the center as well as at the ends. However, the current is highest at the center, which we did discuss previously, which will produce a higher power loss in the loading elements. End loading is preferable because the lower current distribution and lower power loss. And getting back to the QST article, they were getting into the proper locations to put these loading coils in the line of the antenna in series with it, for minimum losses. So here it says the radiation resistance changed appreciably. Tongue twister. The peak current value remains constant as shown in the illustration, and I show the actual currents here. Alright, likewise, the current distribution is approximately the same as if a full-length antenna were used. The efficiency of an antenna is very important. In a perfect antenna, the radiation resistance and the terminal resistance would be equal, meaning that all the energy supplied by the transmitter would be radiated into space. And according to the previous articles, well, discussions, as you have learned, there are also loss resistances present which consume power. Even though the value is very small, this loss resistance prevents an antenna from being 100% efficient. So the loss resistance prevents the antenna, so it's not 100%. I don't think there's no antenna that's 100% efficient anyway, because you always have resistive losses and other losses due to effects of objects around the antenna. we basically want the antenna to be at least a half a wavelength above the ground. But nearby objects, I think that Mike was talking about, if it's a large object, we'll change its impedance and we'll increase its losses and so on. But that could be compensated for with an antenna tuner. And that's what's used in many applications when your antenna is not really matched properly. You use an antenna tuner in the shack to do that job. So because it's not really 100%, the efficiency of the antenna, therefore, is the ratio of the radiated energy to the total energy supplied by the transmitter. Since the antenna cone flows in both the radiation and loss resistances, the efficiency can also be expressed as the ratio of radiation resistance to the total resistance of the antenna system. In a good radiator system, this figure is at least 90%, and at times could be considerably higher. The dipole antenna that I installed actually last summer does not really have the correct impedance because I did a quick job and just put it up there quickly, and I'm feeding it with 450 ohm lateral line, which is really wrong, without a balance. Of course, the 450 ohm lateral line is balanced, is a balanced line itself, but I'm using an antenna tuner to compensate for it. One of the problems with the way I'm doing it is that there's RF getting back into the shack, which I knew that would happen because my SWR is high, because of the matching point. So the power is coming back into the shack from the antenna, and I can see that in my field stage meter. You know, the antenna tuner properly does compensate for that, but it doesn't stop the RF in the shack. If I match properly, at the feed point of the antenna, then very little or no power. There's always some power coming back to the shack, and my field strength readings would be a lot lower. Fortunately, in my case, the RF in the shack is not really affecting things too much at this point. So, continuing, radiation, now the next discussion is radiation patterns. Since we just spoke about antenna loading. And this is the actual pattern that the antenna dipole, in this case, radiates from the dipole. Okay, now if you visualize this, a horizontal dipole antenna is said to have a figure 8 horizontal radiation pattern, and they show a picture of it. So, if you've never seen what that pattern looks like, it's broadside to the antenna. In other words, looking down at the end of the antenna, like looking down the barrel of a gun, there's very little radiated energy at the very ends, coming from the ends. It's along the length of the antenna itself, which is known as broadside to the antenna. And it's in a figure eight pattern, meaning that it's on both sides of the dipole antenna, both sides of the wire. All right, so a horizontal dipole antenna is said to have a figure eight horizontal radiation pattern as shown here. And that's looking down on the antenna. We're looking down from space on the, if we were up higher than the antenna looking down at it, you would see that figure eight pattern. So, looking down to the ground from high up. So because of this pattern, in other words, maximum signal is radiated broadside to the antenna element on each side. Very little or no signal is radiated off the ends of the antenna. Thus, If you desire to direct a maximum signal toward a given compass angle, the antenna elements must be positioned perpendicular or broadside to this direction. So I think if somebody wants to put up a dipole and they want to get their maximum radiation east and west towards Europe or towards California and so on, you basically install the dipole. And it's not exactly true, but it's sort of a rule of thumb. Right, because as the once the antenna once the signal leaves the antenna, it goes all over the place, and you've got different rotation and objects that it hits and bounces from the earth and cancellations and so on. You can sort of understand that. So, as I just said, if you desire to direct the maximum signal towards a given compass angle, the antenna element must be positioned perpendicular or broadside to this direction. In the horizontal dipole antenna, the vertical radiation pattern, now you're looking at the end of the dipole, is a circle, because equal signal levels are radiated in all vertical angles. Right, so again, you know, when you're looking down, and you're going to see that, you know, what looks like a figure eight from above, because you have eight circles on both sides of the antenna. And of course, you know, this is, the illustration is showing basically a perfect antenna that's really in free space, where there's no surrounding objects that's going to affect the pattern. That's never true. So there's always some pattern that is obscured. That's the word I was thinking of. The pattern is obscured because of where it's located, even though it's really not going to affect your signal as far as, you know, or performance, as far as the station that you want to work. Because there are many other factors that affect the signal. But again, generally, rule of thumb is to mount the antenna, as just discussed, in the direction that you want to get your maximum signal. All right, and they show it here, again, in the dipole. They show the dipole looking down at the horizontal pattern and the vertical pattern. So, if you again, if you look at the end of the dipole, like looking down the barrel of a gun, if you got to the very end, you're going to see a circle, because you're going to see this, and that's what this discussion is. You're going to see this radiation pattern equal on both sides, or sort of equal. Okay, so, and again, another illustration, figure 24B. Okay, the converse is true when the dipole antenna is mounted vertically. See, now you're going to take a horizontal dipole and you're going to mount it vertically, which you could do also, by the way. It doesn't have to be horizontal. The vertical radiation pattern is a figure 8 with maximum signal being radiated broadside to the antenna elements, just like the horizontal dipole. And therefore, over the surfaces of the Earth, let me just get this right, and therefore over the surface of the Earth instead of up and down. The horizontal radiation pattern of the vertical dipole is the circle, indicating that approximately the same signal intensity is radiated in all compass angles through 360 degrees. Okay, again, you gotta, you're flipping it around. You're moving it 90 degrees from horizontal to vertical. It still has the same radiation pattern on both sides, Only now it's a vertical antenna rather than a horizontal antenna. Which may be better depending on other factors like noise level. There are different antennas that are designed which reduce the noise level on the HF bands. Like a beverage antenna, for instance, a different design antenna that is only mounted a few feet above the ground. In fact, there was one of the guys on 75 meters was just talking about his recent installation that he made of a beverage type antenna, and his noise level came way down. But it's only used for receiving. He's not using it to transmit, only to receive. So he's got a separate antenna for receiving. A lot of disadvantages of this type of antenna is that you need more space, you need more room, and it's much longer. It's actually reaching a full wavelength. But if you have the property size, it's great. Okay. So it says here, you will learn in this and in future antenna lessons in the future, because I have other lessons to talk about, and how the radiation patterns can be controlled to direct signals into desired areas and in desired directions only. As a result, power can be conserved and need not be radiated in directions where it serves no useful purpose or causes interference. So you could play around with a lot of different things if you're so inclined to do so. Do a lot of experimentation, and there's a lot of articles there on antennas in QST, including the Antenna Handbook, which I highly recommend because it goes into a much deeper discussion than I am having here on the antenna theory. The antenna height above the ground has a decided influence on the vertical radiation pattern. When antennas are mounted 10 or more wavelengths above ground, their radiation resistances and vertical radiation patterns are not influenced seriously by ground effects. However, at lower mounting sites, the influence of the ground must be considered. Actually, the ground acts as a large area reflector, and any wave front from the antenna that strikes the ground is reflected and rises to add or subtract from the antenna signal components radiated at higher angles. And they're showing some illustrations on how the signal from the antenna is reflected from the ground back at a certain angle and then reaches a certain point. So you're actually using the ground to do this, because of the height that the antenna is above the ground. And now we're talking about a vertical antenna here. And again, you have what is called a real antenna signal, and then there's an image antenna signal, which is the reflected part. And that could, as I just mentioned, can add or subtract to, so it could actually cancel the main signal at a certain angle from your antenna, because of the height above ground. So that's what some of the ground effects do. So, as I said, the ground acts as a large area reflector, and any wave from the antenna that strikes the ground is reflected and rises to add or subtract from the antenna signal components radiated at higher angles. And they show here, again, in an illustration. It's also in the Antenna Handbook. So for a horizontal antenna mounted one half wavelength above ground, there is a signal component that travels along the line, which they point, label, they call it line X,